Now, financial crime seems horribly complicated, but there are apparently only so many ways you can con someone out of what's theirs. In fact, there are four. A veteran regulatory economist and market analyst, Dan Davis, has years of experience picking the bones out of some of the most famous frauds of the modern age. Now he reveals in his book, Lying for Money, the big picture that emerges from their labyrinths of deceit. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK. Author of Lying for Money, Dan Davis. Dan, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Oh, you know, not too bad. Another day, another dollar. But talking about dollars, you've written this new book about how people through the ages have been conned out of their hard-earned stuff. And it's not as complicated as some people would think.
Well, yeah, fraud is an interesting crime because it's not like many other kinds of crime. You know, if your house has been burgled, then you know exactly what crime has been committed and your problem is to find out who did it. But in most cases of fraud, it's pretty obvious who was responsible for it as soon as you've realised that a fraud has been committed and the problem is actually identifying that a crime has happened. And that's kind of what makes it interesting, because it's a crime that's not like any of the other kind of normal ways of stealing. It's got a problem of denial as well as a problem of detection.
And I suppose one of the problems is when you get one of these big super fraud trials that we tend to get in the late 80s and the 90s and the bearings and that sort of thing, when it's a massive fraud trial, maybe Guinness as well, there are so many defendants, which means there are so many quote-unquote liars involved.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is the thing. You know, having been tangentially involved in, you know, the inquiry into even quite a simple fraud like Nick Gleeson and the collapse of bearings, it is amazing how a basically very simple crime suddenly blows up into an 8,000-page list of documents. And the reason is, it comes back to what I was saying, it's obvious who committed it as long as there's a crime, but everyone involved will just swear that there's a legitimate explanation for everything. And that means every single piece of paperwork has to be examined in order to prove that there wasn't an innocent explanation for everything. And that's when you start realizing how many pieces of paperwork even the simplest of transactions actually generates in a modern economy, when you have to look through every single one of them in order to prove dishonest intent.
A daunting prospect to begin with. I was working in the city of London. It was when 92, wasn't it, when the bearings financial scandal blew up, I think it was. And I remember... Sorry?
Yes, it was.
And I think I just remember that the shockwaves it sent through, everybody was working in the square mile. Also, Leeson himself, didn't his teeth suffer or something because of that case?
Well, he was, you know, it's not necessarily always the easiest of lives being a multi-million pound fraudster. He stress ate, and one of the things which he stress ate was fruit pastels. And by the time he got caught, he'd actually eaten so many fruit pastels that they eroded the enamel from his teeth, which gives you some idea of the pressure that the guy was under.
Yeah, Rupert Baring was a friend of mine, and I'm sure he would have wished that on him. Anyway, let's move swiftly onwards then. At its simplest, you've written a 300-page book about liars and sort of high famous rogues and financial misdealings. There's some great stories about things like, you know, Queen Victoria unwittingly being put as a financial director in one of these companies.
Yeah. I mean, one of the strange things is that the Victorian period, which we kind of think of as being all straight-laced and very concerned with their image and upright status, it was an absolute hotbed of fraud. Credible historians have estimated that roughly 1/6 of all the companies that were floated on the London Stock Exchange during the Victorian period were frauds of one sort or another. And it was just because it was a revolutionary period in the economy. Everyone was doing new things. And where you've got new innovative things like railways and telegraphs happening, no one really understands what's going on. And that's exactly the situation that fraudsters go for. Everyone knew that the LSE of the period was as crooked as you like. And so the fraudsters tried to give themselves an air of respectability. And one of the ways that you gave yourself an air of respectability was by putting down the names of a lord or a prominent brewer or another kind of pillar of the community on your board of directors. So, Queen Victoria, the Duke of Wellington, made the appearance on the board of directors of some fraudulent insurance companies. This was without telling them.
Right.
Although also there were plenty of peers of the realm who were prepared for a guinea a year to just lend their name to any company that wanted to add a little bit of a touch of class to its prospectus.
And that really sort of stopped me in my track, because I thought, hang on, you think the House of Lords was supposed to be that paragon of virtue, British democracy over the empire as then was. But, you could buy a duke to sit on your board of directors, allegedly.
Yeah, absolutely provably, you definitely could. There was a market in it. They called them guinea pigs because the going rate was one guinea a year. They also had the problem that people have the same names. And so if you had Mr. Perkins and Mr. Drummond on your board of directors, then no one would be necessarily able to tell that they weren't the wealthiest brewer in London and the founder of the Royal Bank of Scotland. They were just two guys with the same name. And they got up to all sorts. There was a railway company that used to file its accounts in code so that nobody could tell how many illegal payments to directors they'd made.
Right. That sounds a workable thing. Also, I like the thing about proving if you're, because it was a time of great exploration, as you said, the empire was opening up new lands, and there was a search for gold, and there was an ingenious ways that frauds could actually prove that their land had gold in it.
Yeah. Versions of this have worked as recently as the 1990s, but you get some gold dust and a shotgun, and you take the shot out of one of the cartridges, put a mixture of sand and gold dust into the cartridge, then fire your shotgun at some rocks on your claim. And now you've got a rock that is streaked through with little bits of gold, and you take that to the assay office and they will certify you as having gold-containing rocks, at which point you get yourself down to, in those good old days, the Vancouver Stock Exchange, and get tout around for investors in your gold mine. Versions of that trick were still working in the 1990s. It's really surprisingly easy to tamper with mineral samples. And once the mineral samples have been certified by a geologist, then who's going to question whether they're real or not? Not most investors.
I mean, you break down the book as well as going through these great historical stories of, daring do and dodgy dealings. But yeah, you've broken fraud down basically, because it seems incredibly complex if you're not in the markets, to four types of fraud: long firm counterfeiting, control fraud, and market crimes. Just briefly let us know what each one is, a brief summary.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the idea here was to sort of deal with exactly the problem you were suggesting, that these trials get so complicated. And everything's complicated in the details, but if you look at the broad principles, you can understand them a lot quicker. The ways that you commit fraud are you borrow money without the intention of paying it back. That's the classic Rennie and Roger Cray long firm game. You fake or forge something that certifies the value of something else. That's a counterfeiting kind of crime. You abuse a position of trust that you've been given over a company or something similar. That's what we call a control fraud. And then you have the weird final category, which is things like insider dealing and environmental certification fraud and cartels, where it's not really a crime in the classic sense. You've got thou shalt not bear false witness and thou shalt not steal covering most of the other ones, but there really is no thou shalt not trade shares while in possession of inside information in the Ten Commandments. These are just rules of a particular marketplace that have been elevated to the status of crimes because that particular marketplace is so important to us all that we've decided to give a special status to its rules.
You've also looked in the book about a huge scandal, the PPI scandal, and how basically in the 90s and the early noughties, UK retail banking got completely out of control and people were basically being fraudulent.
PPI is very interesting to me because it's a really new kind of fraud. It's a strange entity because there's no controlling mind there. What you had was that the people at the top of the UK banks, the Fred Goodwins of this world, set up a set of incentives which made it inevitable that frauds would be committed, because they put out a badly designed product of payment protection insurance into the market, and they gave sales incentives to their branch staff, which made it absolutely inevitable that this product would be sold to people who it should never have been sold to. And so you have this weird situation in which it's obvious that a mega fraud has been committed, but there's just no smoking gun memo. There's no trail of documents leading back to a single controlling mind who decided, let's commit £50 billion worth of fraud against the UK public. It's terribly interesting to me, because can you think of something that's more calculated to undermine confidence in the system as a whole as a situation where you can have £50 billion of fraud, but no one goes to prison, and the only people who are identifiable as being responsible are just ordinary Joe counter staff? It's, you know, you can actually, to my mind, make a decent case that a lot of the populist politics of the last 10 years have their roots in the fact that the banking system, which everyone used to trust, got completely out of control, but did so in a way that there's very difficult to have any criminal sanction against the people responsible.
It is an interesting one, because suddenly the banks and the financial institutions, and we've had this here in Spain, suddenly from just being financial institutions, they became insurers, they became, we find in Spain, real estate agents, they became property speculators. And once you've let that, you try and do 8 billion things apart from sticking to your core business, then you are open to abuse.
Absolutely, absolutely. Oh, man, Spanish banks, I could tell you some stories, probably better not.
We have a few, don't worry about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also, you looked at what I like to see as well. One of the points that you make, though, because I'll come into what I like to see, but one of the points you make is that a little bit of financial excitement, shall we say, and I'm using my words carefully, is better than having a sort of turgid market where nothing happens, and it allows people to speculate, to make money. If you take out all risk out of every financial transaction, then there will be no speculation.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the optimum level of fraud is definitely not zero. And actually, the optimum level of fraud in an economy could be very high indeed. In the book, I basically keep on having a go at Canada, partly because it had the Vancouver Stock Exchange, but partly because I did get ripped off by some Canadian fraudsters myself.
Right, okay.
But it's very interesting. Canada's a weird country because it has extremely high levels of securities fraud. But the reason for that is that Canada is the ultimate high-trust economy. Canadians will trust basically anyone who shows up with a nice suit and who smiles and has a firm handshake and is polite. That means they're very vulnerable to frauds of all sorts, but it also means that if you want to get business done in Canada, you get it done very quickly and very efficiently. And you know, if you look at Canada versus somewhere which has very low incidence of fraud, like, Lebanese merchants who will not do business with anyone whose family they don't know going back to the 4th century.
Right.
It's not obvious to me that Canada has got the wrong end of that trade-off. It seems to me that actually being a high-trust economy is where you want to live in, not a low-trust economy. But one consequence of being a high-trust economy is that you trust people. And if you trust people, then from time to time, you're going to get ripped off by a fraudster.
An interesting concept indeed. I like the Lebanese, but I know quite a few Lebanese business people. And yes, absolutely, they go back to the 4th century and perhaps even beyond. One of the figures as well, Leslie Payne. And now this is a job description and a half. The Cray Twins accountant with the long firm.
Yeah, it's he's just kind of the missing guy of the Cray stories. He doesn't appear in any of the films, but he made about half of their money. The classic Cray Brothers long firm was just you buy a load of fridges or sort of cheap suits on trade credit. You open up your warehouse shop in the East End, have a great big 50% off sale. Everyone comes in, pays cash for them. And then you close down the warehouse, set fire to it if you manage to get some insurance on it, and disappear, leaving all of the trade creditors, you know, out for that much of goods and leaving you with all of the cash proceeds for some stock that you never paid for. And that was extraordinarily profitable for the Krays. It was about half of the revenue of their firm. Actual armed robbery was surprisingly small compared to what Leslie did for them.
And also Reggie, which I didn't have a new, insisted in keeping ledgers. And you've got some great, great entries in these ledgers.
Yeah, it was. It's a real shame that Leslie Payne's autobiography is out of print now. I had to go down to the British Library to get it, because he recalls that Reggie kept on thinking he was a businessman, and so he kept on buying these beautiful leather-bound ledgers, and he would record in them protection money received from social club in Wimbledon and £30 paid to Shoreditch police station. And Leslie kept on begging him, stop doing this. But Reggie kept saying, oh, no, you've got to run this place properly like a business, and writing down all of these illegal transactions.
Absolutely. You know, bribe to Southwark Police. Yeah. I mean, absolutely wonderful stuff. At the end of the day, when you press the send button of this after you publish it, are you left with a sort of sneaking admiration? Do you hope that people will take this book as a bit of a guidebook of what to look out for and hopefully live and hopefully not get ripped off by some Canadians?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. At the end of the day, one of the things that I really discovered in writing the book is in an economy like Britain or Spain, everyone gets one free shot. You know, if you commit a fraud, a long-term fraud in particular, and you have a reasonable story and no prior criminal record, you will probably get away with it. Even the police will agree, everyone gets one free shot at the long-term fraud. But it's not a pleasant way to live your life. I had to read the autobiographies of about 24 different fraudsters in order to write the book. None of them, with the possible exception of Leslie Payne, who, as far as I can tell, was a sociopath, none of them were happy people. They were all made absolutely miserable by what they did, because it's a difficult thing to be a liar. You know, you have to break through some real psychological resistance in order to make your living by being dishonest. And once you've done that, they seem to be quite kind of broken people. So I think my advice on this is, if you've got the intelligence to pull off a fraud, you've got the intelligence to make your living in a way that will bring you a lot more happiness than trying to commit a crime of dishonesty.
The book is called Lying for Money. It's by Dan Davis. It's out now on Profile. Dan, if people want to find out more about you, buy the book. I know that you're pretty prolific on Twitter. How can they find you?
To be honest, Twitter is my main way of keeping in touch with the world these days. If you search my name or D-Squared Digest on Twitter, next project is that I'm writing an American version of the book.
Ooh!
Because the Americans don't really care about the Cray twins, and they don't know what payment protection insurance is, you know, yet. So the American publisher asked me if I could rewrite all the UK cases to be something a little bit more relevant to the Yanks. And that's turned into great fun.
Might there be a couple of Ponzi's in there as well?
I've got the original Charles Ponzi, although he didn't invent it. There was a woman who was the first Ponzi schemer on record. And yeah, but women never get the credit for these things.
Let's have some equal opportunities fraud. That's what I say. The book is called Lying for Money. It's by Dan Davis. Dan, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks very much. Have a great weekend.
You too.